Today's episode is a standalone discussion episode. The next history show should be out by the end of the month. In the meantime, enjoy this latest installment of the movement's discussion show, Stalin for Time. Mechi Anaïs Estevez Cruz is a Dominican activist and anti-imperialist. Her website, Un Vaina Bien Spanish, offers Spanish lessons for heritage speakers living in the diaspora, as well as Dominican history lessons and resources for decolonizing the tourism industry. She joined me on February 18, 2017, to discuss the history of the Dominican Republic, the cult of personality of Rafael Trujillo, and resistance against fascism and white supremacy under Donald Trump. Things got a little real at points, there were some lulls, but we're also going to talk about some very intense political scenarios.
La tierra gira y gira, no dejará de girar, y los tiempos van cambiando, nadie lo puede evitar. Mira que ya viene la revolución, para que se asustan será pa' mejor. Es el pueblo entero el que ya está gritando, ¡viva la revolución! Si el pobre pide justicia.
I'm here with Mechi Anaïs Estevez Cruz, who is, in addition to many other great, wonderful things, is also my sometime Spanish teacher when I am actually being disciplined and taking the classes. So I hope she forgives me if I mispronounce any part of her name, because I'm a bad Guatemalan.
No, that was perfect. That was actually really perfect.
Oh, thank God. Okay, so we are a month into the Trump presidency, and it's been bonkers. It's been wild. It's been scary. I am super thankful that he is apparently as incompetent as, like, we were thinking he would be. Because mm-hmm. If he wasn't, we'd be completely screwed right now. It would, and we might still be screwed, but I'm like, thank God we got some breathing space.
Absolutely. I think it makes it a lot easier to continue to resist now that we see that he's following through on a lot of his campaign promises, especially because a lot of folks didn't actually think he was going to. So, you know, especially in my neighborhood with a lot of more lighter-skinned, white-passing Dominicans have been saying, like, no, we got to give this guy a shot, give him a chance. I think we are now seeing that this guy is not only incompetent, he's incredibly dangerous.
Totally. So, for to let the audience know, Mechi is Dominican. You were born in New York,
born
is that
in
right?
New York. Mm-hmm. And raised between both countries.
Yeah, spent. She was has been back and forth. So, what you know a lot about that I don't really know much about is Dominican history, which mm-hmm. for some reason is one of the things that I never really picked up on.
Yeah,
I know the name of Rafael Trujillo.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know that much about him.
Okay.
Can you give me like a 5-minute basic gist of that history and maybe talk a little bit why that's relevant to Donald Trump?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Dominican Republic has a really long history with the United States, which is what makes it so interesting that so many American citizens don't actually know anything about the Dominican Republic.
Mm-hmm.
For a really long time, the Dominican Republic was plunged into a lot of civil war. There was a lot of unrest, political instability. You know, we were under Spanish colonial rule, had been occupied by the United States twice. And I think a lot of that instability is what gave rise to Trujillo being able to come to power. He was not exactly a very well-known person, was trained by the U.S. Army and stuff, was elected as president, had kind of like weaseled his way onto the ticket, and then pretty soon afterwards kind of named himself Generalissimo,
right?
So was a dictator, although there were elections held. Actually, in fact, the first election in which women were allowed to vote was during Trujillo's regime.
Really?
Yes, I actually. Yeah, it's fascinating.
What was the thought process? Was he trying to look for more legitimacy by doing that, or like how did that come about?
You know, I'm not 100% sure, except that I recall that it was, you know, fairly early on in his regime, They were granted the right to vote, but it didn't necessarily come about until the early 40s, maybe 1941. I think it was just time for women to start joining the political sphere in terms of voting, especially because women in the Dominican Republic have always been a huge part of a lot of our resistance movements, even though they're often forgotten. So Trujillo went on to rule for some 30-odd years, and it was a violent time where political dissent was met with harsh, often violent incarceration, and then disappearances were really big. The leftists were shoved into hiding. He was very anti-communist, and as a result, was a great ally for the United States during the bulk of his dictatorship. Does that cover most of it?
Yeah. One of the things that I learned about when I was doing the research for this was that he had two interesting policies of his. One, that he was very welcoming to Jewish refugees, Japanese immigration. There was one other like ethnic group, I forget what it was, that he was very welcoming to, but at the same time had a ethnic cleansing policy that
yes.
killed, I saw like some pretty, like tens of thousands was some of the numbers that I saw
yes.
of Black Dominicans, Haitians. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that I think is really fascinating, I'm going to kind of connect it to Donald Trump, is that both Trump and Trujillo had very distinctive looks about them, were very much into what they look like. And one of the things that Trujillo was really famous for was powdering his face. So he tried as hard as he could to whiten himself, which has a lot to do with why he had such a welcoming policy to Ashkenazi Jews fleeing the Holocaust and to Japanese immigration. When Trujillo found out that there was so much commerce and community along the border with Haiti, and not only along the border with Haiti, but in fact also in the Samaná province on the northeastern part of the island, where we had actually previously in the 1800s mass immigration of African Americans from the United States and from other Anglophone nations. So it was a very, very richly Black area of the country where, you know, even a dialect of English is spoken there that's not spoken anywhere else. He firebombed the city.
Jesus.
Yeah, he set the province of Samaná on fire as a warning shot to the Black Dominicans there that this kind of cultural melting was not to be tolerated. And yes, what happened, we call it the Parsley Massacre in 1937, is one of the most... from what I understand, it's the largest massacre to happen on Antillean soil, meaning, you know, no one else has killed this many people in such a short amount of time in what is our region. Tens of thousands. There isn't really a full, like, concrete record of the number, but it's a deep scar that runs along that part of the country that is still remembered to this day.
To bring it to present, can you talk a little bit about the... I remember I didn't keep up with the news on this too intensely as I should have, but I remember a year or two ago when there was this whole thing in the news where they were planning on doing mass deportations of Haitians. And this was not years ago. This was literally in the last couple of years that was going on. One of the interesting things I remember seeing is some of the Dominican people that I had on, like, my social media feed, a lot of them were in denial, saying that it was not an ethnic cleansing. They took great umbrage to the use of that term. And I don't, you know, I'm not an expert in the Dominican Republic, and I didn't pay attention to the story with the detail that I should have, but I just felt like I was seeing a lot of the normal arguments and, like, processes that people go through when they are, in fact, engaged in ethnic cleansing or apologizing for it. Can you fill us in on some of the details about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think one of the things that bringing it to present is really important when we start talking about mass deportations, when a government does not, in fact, have the funds to do that, is that by these threats of the deportation and the violence that will follow, many people actually self-deport. So we saw a mass movement of Dominico Haitians and Haitians out of the Dominican Republic and back to Haiti. And so one of the big issues here was the reason why folks were doubling down that it was not an ethnic cleansing is that, in fact, something that we call La Sentencia was passed, a constitutional amendment in which, in essence, based on what they were calling a clerical error, Dominicans of Haitian descent were being stripped of their citizenship because, according to the government, they were never, in fact, entitled to it in the first place. So this meant that, you know, lots of Dominicans of Haitian descent who had been living inside the country, who know nothing of Haiti, who are Dominican, were now finding themselves stateless.
That sounds terrifying. Yeah. I remember one of the things I've been thinking about the last couple of years was, even before Donald Trump announced his candidacy for president, there were rumblings among some of the more right-wing Republicans in the United States Congress talking about repealing the 14th Amendment, or at least getting rid of birthright citizenship.
They've been trying to do it in Texas for some time.
It sounds just absolutely terrifying. I mean, like me, you know, like, I mean, I personally think, like, you know, if you're young, you're born in another country and you're brought here young, then anybody who wants to deport you is a monster, like, easily.
Absolutely.
But, like, my situation is I was born here. I was born in the United States. I was conceived in Guatemala. I got lucky and I was born here. The idea of losing my citizenship or being deported to Guatemala, my Spanish is terrible. It's really bad. And I'm, you know, we've been working on it. But, yeah. I mean, just the thought that thinking we are a step closer to a possible scenario where what you're talking about happening in Haiti, and Americans don't like to think about ourselves as though it were a third world country. You know, we like to think that we're above that whole thing. But a lot of people have been pointing out that we are acting more and more like these political systems that we've often created or Absolutely. Had a part in creating. Yeah. It's coming back home.
Yep.
So I look at this Haiti example and I think, man, we just moved a step closer in the direction of doing that sort of thing.
Absolutely.
My mom's, who's born in Guatemala City, she herself, and she's not like a super overtly political person. She has, you know, class consciousness, but like, she's not like super academic about this shit. She's been saying, like, it just feels more and more like Guatemala.
Absolutely.
And that's not a good thing.
No, it's something that I've been telling people for a long time, actually. What differentiates the United States from a country like the Dominican Republic is really just perception. We talk a lot about the corruption in the Dominican Republic, about how, you know, you can pay government officials to, you know, hire your company to do, you know, if you're building a road or whatever in your concrete company, you can pay government officials to create a contract with you. But I think, you know, we talk a lot about corruption. And if you look at the way that government functions with lobbies, and these lobbyists and these folks who pay for different presidential campaigns and different campaigns and stuff, when you have like a massive oil lobby, you know, paying for whoever's campaign, the reality is that we're not going to get clean, sustainable energy anytime soon. Because it's not in the benefit of these folks who are cashing in on these circumstances. So we've got a lot of corruption. I think the fact that we have now a government in the United States filled with so many incompetent people shows, you know, this is pretty much the way that the government works in the Dominican Republic as well.
Word. So what Trujillo I thought was really interesting because of all the cult of personality stuff.
Absolutely.
And like, Donald Trump, it's weird because, like, they look very different. The styles are very different. But, like, we got to remind ourselves these are very different political and historical contexts. So they're not going to look the same. But I did notice there were some weird-ass similarities as far
Absolutely.
As obsession with themselves.
So much obsession with themselves. I don't know if you know this, actually, but in the Dominican Republic, everybody was forced to have pictures of Trujillo hanging in their house.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
It's weird because, like, in the United States, we're not necessarily forced to have pictures of Donald Trump in our houses, at least not yet. And yet, I see his face in a lot of people's homes, not necessarily because they have a picture of him, but, like, you know, there's people out there who have, like, Donald Trump of the board game. Did you know that was a thing?
No, I actually didn't.
He has a board game.
Oh.
Yeah. I think it's like a Monopoly type of game or something like that. Ew. But it's like, I'll be at someone's house having some drinks, having a good time, and then out of the corner of my eye, I see Donald Trump.
Yikes.
In a suit, looking all like, you know, alpha male and shit. Ugh. And I'm like, that's a goddamn board game.
That is, you know... I think that if Trujillo had existed in the time of board games, etc., he probably would have done pretty much the same thing. And it's interesting that you talk about the similarities between the two. One of the things I like I crack this joke all the time, is that, you know, Trump spends a lot of time making himself orange with that horrible comb over, whereas Trujillo used to powder his face and also had a very distinctive mustache that he was very into trimming, a la Hitler, with a straight mustache. They used to actually joke about call him Little Bottle Caps because he wore so many medals on his jackets. Oops. One of the things about Trujillo that's super fascinating was just how obsessed he was with himself, how poorly he took criticism, how poorly he took people making fun of him, something that I think we see Trump is... very similar in that he does not like for folks to laugh at him. And Trujillo was the same exact way.
Huh. So one of the things that I've been like trying to struggle with is trying to find like comparisons. Like, I like history. It's something I can enjoy learning about. I get real into it. But then, like, how do you make the argument that like Dominican history or the Spanish Civil War history or anything like that, how do you make that relevant to our current situation? Like, that's something that I've been struggling with. I do think I wouldn't be doing this podcast if I didn't think it was important, but it does kind of feel abstract. Like, we're not yet at the point where I think we should be, like, digging up our arms caches and, like, you know, starting, like, seizing buildings and, you know, doing all that sort of thing. But, like, I don't know. I feel like, well, maybe it's time to, like, get those arms caches ready?
Absolutely. I think the thing is that all of this, the movement to power, is very insidious in the way that it functions, right? So Trujillo came into power in an election, a democratic election, in quotations. You know, and at first, there are a lot of things that people point to during Trujillo's time that were great, you know, like Santo Domingo was developed, and it wasn't like right away he seized power and the next day civil liberties were suspended, right? It takes time. Especially one of the things that's the most concerning is that I think we see in history this propensity to find a scapegoat, focus on that scapegoat, and so long as we're focusing on the dangers of this group of people, people are very willing to start letting go of not only their own rights, but the rights of their neighbors, right? We saw this after 9/11,
mm-hmm.
you know, with the Patriot Act. We saw this in the Dominican Republic. Trujillo, there are a lot of people who will deny that Trujillo ever even killed people along the border during the Parsley Massacre. And yet there is a speech that he made where he talks and he says, if my hands are stained in blood, they are stained in blood, you know, because I've been trying to protect our nation from this growing Pacific threat of these people who are coming in and they have no respect for our custom. They have no respect for our history. They have no respect for, he's talking about the Haitians here, they have no respect for what this country was founded on, our three founding fathers, the principles on which this country stands. They're thieves. And he criminalized them so much so that folks began to focus on these people instead of focusing on this mounting, not only loss of civil liberties, but this increasingly more and more violent government. So I think if we wait until we get to that point, it will be too late. So we're talking about a time when it was much easier in our countries, in countries like yours and countries like mine, to get arms together and fight back against the government. We are now living in an age of total surveillance.
Yeah.
Where it's not the same.
Well, the thing is like, you know, if we were to actually try an armed revolt right now, we'd all be dead, like, tomorrow.
We'd be dead in less than 24 hours. Absolutely. You know, and it's not just because they're surveilling us, but because of this whole, like, liberal not wanting to have guns thing that we've been arguing with the conservatives. And while we've been arguing about gun rights, they've been stockpiling on guns.
Mm-hmm.
And we have been talking about how we shouldn't have any.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, I'm not... Like, I find gun culture, American gun culture, super creepy and gross.
Absolutely.
And, like, super masculine in the most toxic goddamn way.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, it's just... I don't like it.
Nope.
But,
I agree.
You know, I look at it and I'm just like, what... So, like, for me, when I was doing this research on the Spanish Civil War... One of the things I found just the most mind-blowing and frustrating, terrifying, what have you, is the period when that whole conflict was decided was the first 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
There is a possibility that the Republic could have won throughout the war, but those first 2 days were really, really critical. And the major mistake that they made was waiting almost 2 days to actually start arming working class people.
Absolutely.
They still had some arms caches. Anarchists and some of the other revolutionaries had hidden things for a while, knowing that this was probably going to happen. Because everybody knew that there was a good chance there would be a military coup at some point. But for the most part, they didn't give people guns because they were terrified at the prospect of working class people being armed. Now, the American situation and the Spanish in the 1930s, very different. I think ours, there's much more of a racist component to it. Spanish Civil War, it was really just it was more of a class concern.
Yeah.
Here nowadays, I think it's like, you know, for the white liberal, it's like, well, I want gun control because I want to be able to get that cheap rent out in East New York,
right.
You know, and shit like that, you know, or... You know, Roxbury, Massachusetts, Chelsea, Massachusetts.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, all those sorts of things. And it was just so frustratingly for me was when they had that debate in Congress, the filibuster on where they wanted gun control and they filibustered. And what they were advocating for was to make it so that if you were on the no-fly list, you couldn't buy a gun. And I was like, guys, you realize that the no-fly list is one of the most racist lists. And we have many lists in this country that are quite racist. That is one of them.
Yeah. See, I didn't know that. I don't know. When did this happen?
This was like last summer, I want to say.
Okay, yeah. I was living in the Dominican Republic. So it was like, you know, as you know, that's where I live. So I am a little bit disconnected from all this. I actually didn't hear that. But, you know, absolutely, I think one of the reasons why... gun culture exists the way that it exists. It would look very different if mainstream gun culture was a whole bunch of brown and black folks walking around with guns on their hips. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But I think also one of the things that keeps liberal white people from, you know, participating in, you know, they want to separate themselves from that, you know, real Southern, real toxic masculinity, gun-toting folks, you know, and they want to separate themselves from that. But the reality is, that, you know, we can pretend that peaceful protest, we can pretend that that's something that's going to win this. But so long as the people who support Trump have guns, and we don't, we are hilariously outgunned.
And, like, I have no illusions that, like, having an armed, you know, black and brown working class would lead to revolution. Like, you know, that grit you took. Like, I get it. It's going to be ugly.
Yeah.
A lot of people
are going
to
die.
My whole thing is, like, it doesn't have to. I'm not advocating that tomorrow.
Yeah.
I'm advocating that maybe a week from now. But I am advocating that tomorrow. I get that.
Yeah.
But, like, the fact is when you have a butt ton of, you know, working class people, especially if you're living in a society where racism is a major problem, as we certainly do here, and those particular communities have arms and also political organization independent of the system around them.
Yeah.
That means they have power. They have power that you cannot control. It's not the same power as having power, you know, in the Congress, yeah. but it is a power nonetheless. And that's something yeah. I feel like the United States left, which I have a lot of issues with. We don't talk about dual power, the idea of creating independent structures that are basically providing some of the services that a state would or a government would. So whether that's, you know, like the Black Panthers, great example with the free breakfast.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that was one of the most important examples of a real liberation revolutionary movement in the United States that we've had.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, I think one of the things that Occupy tried to do that was very inspirational, however, you know, however problems it may have had, was the General Assembly having alternative ways of making decision making, all the consensus stuff, you know, that sort of thing. I think that we need to do more of that sort of, in conjunction with arming yourselves yeah. and all those
sorts
of things.
But I think it's a lot easier for them, right? Like, these the people that we're fighting against, like these white supremacists, have one binding thing among them, that they're all white and they're all afraid of white genocide. But we're talking about trying to mobilize people of all different races, of all different religions, of all different ethnicities. And that makes it a lot harder because mm-hmm. there's a lot of infighting for us. You know, a lot of anti-blackness in the Latino community.
Yeah.
You know, anti-Islamophobia. This is something that is not just, even if white supremacy and white people have created it and are really the ones that have the most stake in it. It's not to say that I haven't heard people make incredibly Islamophobic comments in, you know, marginalized communities. So it's a lot harder to, you know, build a mass movement among all of us when we're too busy fighting about a whole bunch of different things. And that's one thing that they have that we don't have. Does that make sense?
No, totally.
Yeah. Which is depressing when you think about it.
I mean, white supremacy has the advantage.
Absolutely.
That's the really rough thing about the... The inverse of that, though, is that they have the advantage, but they also are cowards.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, that's the thing about fascism that, like, I've been trying to, like, tell people, is that fascism is terrifying. Fascism can cause great, great revolutionary, in the worst sense, kind of changes to the society, but they're cowards. And if you can destroy their sense of power, they are useless.
Yep.
When they lose that power, they lose the ability to organize themselves, they lose the ability to communicate politically, they just fall apart.
Yep.
And right now, we're watching them gain so much confidence.
Absolutely.
And embrace their sense of power. And that's that has got to stop.
Yeah. Well, and it's also one of the things that's, like, really scary. It's like, I remember one time talking to a friend who told me, tomorrow we could walk out and we could kill all the white people. We really could. We could round them up, kill them all. Kill their children. Kill all of them. And white supremacy would not cease to exist. That's the biggest problem with it, though, is that how it has kind of wormed its way into all of our consciousness,
mm-hmm.
you know, in terms of things like colorism, you know, Dominicans as a post-colonial people who have absorbed a lot of white supremacist ideals of intelligence, beauty standards, you know, worth, who's more worthy of certain things, of occupying space. That's also one of the scary things. You know, the white supremacy as a machine is so well-oiled. It's got so many moving parts. And in a lot of ways, through respectability politics, through, you know, colorism, through so many things, they've actually managed to get some of us working within that machine, in service of that machine, even when it's not to our best interest.
Mm-hmm.
Which is fucking terrifying when you think about it. I said the F word twice.
I will edit out and I got two things to say. One, I can edit out the excessive swear words. We will sometimes edit them out, sometimes we'll let them happen, like, whatever, try and keep it, you know, whatever. And number two, I would like to point out that we made it almost 30 minutes without talking about killing the white people. All right. White people, we don't want to do it.
We We don't bring it to that point. Don't make us do it.
Like, so, and you mentioned white genocide earlier.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some white genocide for a moment. The white people can get real sensitive about that sort of thing. And yet, one of the reasons why someone like myself and many others feels very comfortable joking about that sort of thing is because it ain't going to happen. It's a pipe dream. It's we're not even close to any situation. We don't have that power. We don't have that organization. And I personally don't want to kill all the white people.
You know,
like me personally, I'm only speaking for myself.
Okay.
So no
comment.
but you know what I'm saying? It's like for them, it is anything that even remotely challenges the status quo
of white power majority and white power
is seen as a threat.
Have you seen that interview with Jorge Ramos and the white guy where he talks about white genocide and how in order for brown people to get power, white people have to lose power, and he's not about that life? You haven't seen that?
No, when was this? I did not see that.
I just saw it today on like Occupy Facebook.
Was this dude associated with like the alt-right movement or like a specific white supremacist movement?
You know, he was spitting out that rhetoric. So he did straight up say that white people and Asian people are smarter than black people and that Latinos shouldn't be here. He did in fact say that, but I don't actually know who the guy is. So I know who Jorge Ramos is because I'm a good Latina, but like, you know, I don't know who the other white guy was. I don't, you know, but he spoke about like white genocide. He spoke about, you know, this is our land. This is our country. Not once did they mention Native Americans, by the way, which, you know, womp. But yeah, he was like clearly saying that white people are superior. He talked about white genocide. He talked about white people becoming the minority and how scary that was. And for me, you know, I think one of the things that also brings it to a head is when you think about the Haitian Revolution, right?
Oh, shit's about to get real.
Yeah, shit's about to get real.
Oh, man.
You know, this is the reason why they are afraid of becoming the minority.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Right? Because especially during slavery times, right, you had more slaves than you did white people. Mm-hmm. And they were always terrified that, you know, as is what happened in the Haitian Revolution, people get fed up of what the fuck was going on, and that in the middle of the night, people just rise up and slit everybody's throats in their beds.
And yet, the more they try to disempower and to disorganize and to repress, the more they create the desire
to do all of these things. Absolutely.
Yeah, because, like, man, and this is what I'm saying, is like, you know, the history I talk about in my politics, like, it freaks people out sometimes.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
I get it.
Yeah.
We're talking about some really fucked up, intense shit.
Yeah.
But, like, my whole thing is, like, even people in situations where they are committing righteous violence, even righteous lethal violence, mm-hmm. I ain't gonna weep for a second for slaves cutting off their master's head and, like, you know, all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know? Even in those situations, you just gotta know that there was a lot of trauma that
absolutely
preceded that action.
Absolutely.
And trauma that was experienced in the act of committing these killings. I don't care who you are, what your cause is, even if it's me and my own cause, committing violence, it's going to mess with you. It's going to psychologically damage you. So, like, my whole thing is, like, can we just, like, stop making this more likely?
Yeah, right? Well, no, but the thing is that it's also just, like, interesting the way that Americans and white Americans look at violence, right? They hear us talking about militant, righteous violence, lethal violence, and they're like, what the fuck, man? Peace. We gotta do this peacefully. What are you doing? Stop rioting. Stop breaking shit, right? But you look at the way that they react to freedom movements that they do agree with in the Middle East or in Latin America, and that's when we see killing as, okay, these are the same people who you don't see saying anything about the torturing that's happening or was happening or don't know if it's still happening in Guantanamo. You know, we're seeing all of these reports of some brutal ass interrogation tactics, like straight up torture, and these people are fucking silent about it. You know, it's like really convenient to be, to pick and choose what kind of violence and whose death, you know, hurts your heart. And this is, and the reality is, at least to me, all life is not sacred. You know, I don't agree with that. I think, are we allowed to talk about killing neo-Nazis now?
Oh, we're always allowed to talk about killing Nazis.
Yeah, let's kill, you know, let's
this,
kill
some, okay, I'm just going to say this right, I'm just going to state this for the record right now. This podcast is not advocating killing fascists and Nazis, but we have no problems with it, you know?
Yeah, you know, we're talking in hypotheticals right now.
I mean, there nothing in history tells you that it's a bad idea.
Absolutely, right? Absolutely. And the reality is, we talk about life being sacred, you know, and I don't understand how a country that's like super into World War II, by the way.
Yeah.
Like, America's like reverence of World War II is so incredibly at odds with the white liberal response to Richard Spencer getting his ass handed to him. Not once. But twice did you peep the homegirl, because there was a dude. There was also a woman who straight up clocked his ass in the face.
Was this the same day?
It was the same day. You didn't see that meme?
I saw that happen twice. I did not see.
I'm pretty sure in that second meme, that because the first one that got popularized was like the white dude with the bandana over his face. The second one was definitely this brown homie, this homegirl, just fucking plow. Hit him right up, straight in the face. Cold cocked his ass. You know, the white liberal response to that was wild. How can a country that's like super into talking about killing the Nazis be so sad that a modern day Nazi got cold cocked? He's still alive. They didn't even kill his ass.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. It's like, okay, so my whole thing about, you know, violence against fascists is when you cross that line into being a straight up fascist, whatever happens to you happens. And my only concern, morality, I don't care. What I care about is like the political result. And that sounds cold as hell. And I get that. But again, like for me, it's like, all right, if you're just like some random libertarian dude, yeah, I think your opinions are crap. But I don't want you dead.
Yeah.
I don't want to commit physical violence against you. Even with like, you know, a registered Republican who like has crappy opinions on like taxes and stuff like that and gay marriage, I don't even want physical harm to come to them. But what people don't understand, these white liberals, is crossing, or liberals in general, let's be serious.
Yeah, absolutely.
When you cross that line from just having a, you know, a trash opinion to organizing violence, and that's what fascism is. Even if you are not literally part of a gang roaming the streets terrorizing Muslim or Latin neighborhoods, when you are doing something like outing people, you know, putting up people's names and information doxing about them
people,
and telling people you need to go after this person, and it's being done specifically in the name of the alt-right or of Donald Trump or of all these things. Like, nope, you have crossed the line into fascism. And
I would say, I would take it a step further. I think for us, for folks that come from histories like us, even just the words are enough to trigger memories of what most of us have come from. So a lot of us are here in the United States directly as a result of the empire rolling up into our countries, taking all of our fucking resources, impoverishing us, and then making life really difficult in our country so that we end up having to come to this festering shithole to try to find a better future for ourselves, to then be marginalized and treated like second-class citizens. So these words that to some people, you know, ideas about gay marriage, you know, these, they bring very real memories of things that we left behind not so long ago. You know, in the Dominican Republic, we talk about Trujillo. We talk about Balaguer. That was 12 years of a dictatorship in everything but name. Huge, you know, violent persecution of leftists in the Dominican Republic. Those are decades upon decades, like 80 years of repression and fear. You know, and it's something that, like, you know, real talk, I was arrested in 2014 at a Black Lives Matter protest after the non-indictment of the man who assassinated Eric Garner. We hit the streets that day. I got arrested at Times Square. It was all jokes and games on the bus. It was all jokes and games while we were handcuffed in the streets. We were all cracking jokes because whatever. And it wasn't until we actually got put into the cages, our individual cages, there were like six or seven of us in there, and I realized that they were calling us bodies. They stop referring to you as a person, by the way, when you're arrested. They call you a perp or a body. The first time I realized, he came, a police officer walked into the to where we were being held and said, how many bodies are in there? How many bodies are in there? And my heart stopped. And I thought to myself, oh my God, they're going to kill us. They're going to kill us.
If this had been like Guatemala.
If this had been the Dominican Republic.
We'd be on a helicopter being thrown into the ocean.
Into the ocean. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, and so for us, it triggers, you know, memory that's encoded into our DNA. Because did I live that? No, I didn't. But I do have a general mistrust of the police, general mistrust of the armed forces of this country and how military, you know, powered it is. But that moment when they said how many bodies are in there, and I thought they're going to fucking kill us all, and my parents do not know where I am. That was a memory that I really truly believe was triggered inside my DNA, that I carry that encoded in my blood. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, I mean, this is actually, I'm not a science expert, but there is a whole thing about, like, experiences are, like, that you experience in your life, not that are not in your genes necessarily, can be passed on. I think it's called epigenetics, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
Where, like, it's not just your genetic coding that was passed down. It's also your genes and your experiences, like, they actually interact with each other. So things that happen to you, your offspring will experience.
Absolutely.
Will carry on. And, like, this is, Google it. Like, yeah. I'm going to have to Google it because I don't remember it that good.
I thought it was called, like, intergenerational trauma. Like, one of the first times I realized I had PTSD, I was watching a Black professor, whose name I can't remember right now, talking about trauma in Black Americans because of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
And when she was talking, I was like, oh my God, these are all of my symptoms. I have all of these symptoms. And that's when I realized, oh my God, I have PTSD. And then I was diagnosed a short while afterwards. But that intergenerational trauma that we do, you know, trauma rewires your brain. Mm-hmm. It rewires the way that your brain functions. It rewires the way that you view the world. And even if it didn't have anything to do with our genes, the way that we raise our children.
Oh, yeah.
You know, a raising, I don't know how to say this in English, una crianza was informed by trauma, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, as a victim of sexual assault, I would most likely do everything in my power to teach my children to not, to, like, avoid those situations, you know, and I would probably become, really begin to, like, Don't drink and don't take your drinks to the bathroom. You're like, don't, you know. And these are things that we pass on to our children without even realizing that we're doing it. They won't have had to live those experiences. Maybe we did. And we pass on that fear. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's where I think, you know, to loop it back, sometimes when people talk about supporting people's right to speech, so long as they're not mobilizing people to create acts of violence, these words are violent. These words cause deep-seated reactions of fear and terror. What they are doing is they are terrorizing us with these words. You know, your trash opinions on gay marriage are costing gay youth their lives,
mm-hmm.
who are feeling yeah. that deep sense of rechazo, rejection, and are killing themselves. You know, we are seeing a world that is entirely transphobic, is entirely, like, homophobic, and it is costing our youth and adults their lives. So I'm all for advocating the death of people with all the trash opinions. If you have a trash opinion, you know, you shouldn't be allowed to breathe.
oh man. Oh.
I had too much to drink.
You had what? One beer?
Two? I'm on my second one. You I'm had lightweight. Two? Okay.
Yeah, we're having a celebration today, so we decided to have some beers during the recording. After this, we're going to go get funky for a bit. you know, I normally don't do these podcasts while drinking, but you know, it's the day. I feel like we got to do it.
Like, yeah, it's not only the day. But, you know, I did tell you we were going to get a little bit ghetto up in here. So. What better way to get ghetto than to eat some chicharrones, be drinking some beer, and talking about, you know, the Haitian Revolution and slitting out slave masters' throats.
Oh, man. It's so...
It's got really real.
Here's the thing. My history episodes are like, I'm talking about some really militant shit. And I talk about really intense things in a fairly non-judgmental way that, like, isn't exactly advocating for all the things I talk about. But it's like, you know, whenever I see a documentary about the Spanish Civil War or, like, do some reading about it, they will talk about the violence committed by the Republicans as, like, more or less, like, equal to what's being done by the nationalists. Sometimes they will mention that, like, oh, it was disorganized on the Republican side, where it was more organized on the nationalist side, but they do the bullshit like both sides committed atrocities. And I am generally not an advocate for, like, executing people, but sometimes that is, like, politically a good idea.
Politically, I think, yeah, absolutely.
And, like, and politics is life or death a lot of the time. So it's like, absolutely. I mean, how can we freaking judge that sort of thing, you know?
I just don't understand, you know, going back to, like, America's absolute infatuation with World War II and with the French Revolution.
Dude, how many... Okay, so that's, like, two excellent examples. Because how many people were just burned to death in the firebombings of Dresden, of Tokyo, all those sorts of things. And, like, I'm in a weird position because I'm actually against the dropping of the atomic bomb, but I am okay with, like, the firebombing of Dresden up to a point. Like, I need to, like, do my research, but I do feel like, you know, at a certain point, when you're in total war, like, and total war doesn't happen very often, legitimate targets, you know, become all kinds of things you wouldn't expect. And then with the French Revolution, you know, people will sometimes talk about that and be like, oh, it was so terrible. All these people got their heads chopped off. All these people died. And I'm like, yeah, but do you like freedom of religion? Do you like legal protections?
Wait, you actually know people who do that? All the people I know are like, woohoo, French Revolution. That's not the way that I studied it.
Yo, I went to high school and college with a lot of white liberals.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. I mean, I went to Bronx Science, so we had a lot of brown kids. We also had a lot of white kids. But that's fascinating. I just also think it's just, like, really at odds with the current folks, like, obsession with the Hunger Games.
Right.
You know, like, and I actually published a status about this on Facebook a while back where I was like, y'all, like, before the election, I was like, do you guys want to vote for, you know, President Snow or whatever that crazy white bitch's name was? I can't remember.
I have actually not seen The Hunger Games or read it.
I haven't read it, but I've seen the movies. But that's, like, total dystopian. Mm-hmm. Segregation, everybody's poor as fuck, the government is really whack, the, you know, up and coming alternative is also really whack, you know, and but, like, you know, it was war, and in war innocent people die, which is fucking horrible.
Well, it's why things should not be allowed to get to that point. But when it does...
When it does, it becomes, I believe, our responsibility to wage war against governments, especially those of us who have the privilege to be able to, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, for folks who don't have anything to lose, because it's just that bad, to fight so that our children and our children's children inherit a country that we can be proud of, you know, and in its 200 plus like miserable history, this country has not, should not make anybody proud. You know, like, it's a country that's based on genocide and slavery.
So a lot of people right now in this, like, very wide umbrella of resistance to Trump right now, there's this whole idea of, like, you know, trying to... It's that Bill Clinton line that is such bullshit. But it used to make sense to me when I was young and naive, which is, there's nothing wrong with America that can't be fixed by what is right. You know, that idea of, like, we need to restore these values. And, like, don't get me wrong, I do think that there are certain aspects to, like, the American political experiment that made sense.
Oh, yeah.
And that had some values.
And had merit, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, for example, checks and balances, I think, is a really great value to have in a political system. I think the quotes from the founding fathers, I forget which one, about, like, when you have perpetual warfare, democracy is going to erode and be destroyed.
Yeah.
I'm like, yes, absolutely. And, you know, early American history, there was many wars of extermination, but when it came to, like, constant, like, it wasn't even close to what we do now.
Yeah.
And we are seeing what happens. So, like, I do think that there are certain things that are worthwhile, you know, but in general, it's like, okay, you can look at what the idea was.
Yeah.
The ideal. If you look at it, the most generous.
Yeah.
But then you have to compare that with what the result was.
And what the reality was.
Yeah. And, like,
right?
Yeah, you know, and, like, so, you know, for me, I'm like, I think if our resistance to Trump is going to actually create a better world as opposed to just make the crap slow down.
Yeah.
We need to throw away these illusions.
Absolutely.
You know, like, I can't tell you, when I go to these rallies and I see, you know, a white person with a sign that says we are all immigrants, and I'm like, No. Many of us
don't
are
do that.
Settler colonialists or slaves.
No. Don't do that.
And I get what you're trying to say. I get it.
But no. Just no.
No,
it's absolutely, it's like, I was at a protest the day that the protests erupted at JFK. There was also one at the Brooklyn courthouse I attended. And, you know, when the news came out that the stay had been granted and these people were going to be allowed into the country and to go home, some white people were like, USA, USA. And we were just like, no. No, don't do that. And, like, this whole, like, this land is your land, this land is my land shit, like, no.
First of all, that song was written by a communist and, like, had lyrics in it that were about private property being a bad thing.
Yeah.
People forget that and they don't like to talk about that part.
I'm sorry, but, like, how are we shocked by that? How many people co-op Martin Luther King Jr. While condemning people, like, these protests without realizing that Martin Luther King Jr. regularly fucked shit up. Like, disrupted the status quo, blocked traffic, you know.
Organized children to be in, like, at these protests where there might be, like, hoses and dogs.
And dogs, absolutely, you know.
Liberation is ugly sometimes.
It's absolutely
a lot of the time.
A lot of the times, absolutely. And I think one of the things is that, like, it's in our blood, you know. I think a lot of people don't realize, like, you know, nobody does striking like Dominicans do, right? Because we shut shit down.
Mm.
You cannot, like, we are out in the streets burning tires, okay? Like, everything is on fire. And we're just like, no. Like, when we get fed up, shit's gotta burn. And I just don't understand, you know, what it is that is stopping us from burning things to the ground here. Because I think it's like people are afraid of what the consequences are, but the reality is that for the most vulnerable, marginalized people of our society, shit is already really, really bad. People are already dying. And they're dying for no reason. So, you know, if folks are gonna die, at least we should be dying on our feet. Like Lil Wayne said.
I was gonna say Emiliano Zapata, but yeah, sure. Lil Wayne, we'll go.
Lil Wayne. Lil Wayne did say that. He said never. No. He's like, when I leave this earth, it's gonna be on both feet. Never knees in the dirt. Okay, class A lyrics.
Yo, I think this is an excellent note to end on.
Yeah.
Mechie, thanks so much for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Mechie's teaching resources and blog can be found at unabainabienspanish.com. I can tell you firsthand, she's a great Spanish teacher, so check out her online and like her page on Facebook under unabainabienspanish. And for my gringos out there, baina is spelled with a V. The Movements is a left-wing history podcast. Find us on Stitcher, iTunes, Google Play, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at MovementsPod. Send questions, comments, and good faith criticisms to movementspod@gmail.com. Abrumémonos todos en la lucha final. El ser humano es la internacional. Abrumémonos todos.